MMH. The home of rock radio.
This is Matthew Brooks for MMH Radio, and I'm joined today by Kevin Hoffin, a lecturer at Birmingham City University. He lectures in criminology, and we're going to be talking about politics in relation to heavy music, specifically politics as it relates to black metal, because I'm a bit of an outsider to black metal, and I don't want to go in and make a lot of assumptions about things. And this is feeding into an article that I'm writing about politics and heavy music in general. So I want to pick Kevin's brain on things because he's done some research into sort of the kind of social background of black metal in a way. Is that a decent summarization of the work that you've done?
I'd say that works pretty well. Yeah, that's that describes perfectly.
Yeah, brilliant. So people like myself who are a bit of an outsider to black metal have this sort of loose awareness of black metal, and when we've spoken previously, you've mentioned how it's sort of usually focused around the second wave Norwegian scene, with the violence and the church burnings and the sort of links to far right aesthetics and potentially the ideology as well. Can you sort of break down a little bit of that history to give us some context that people outside the scene might not be aware of as much?
All right, okay. So, like you said, black metal tends to focus on the second wave, which is kind of unfortunate, really, because there was some really good stuff that came before that. But as a genre, it never has really managed to successfully escape the shadow of the violence and the criminality in the Norwegian scene. I mean, we're 30 years later and we're still talking about the same sort of things. But basically what happened is in Norway, there was a series of sort of like middle-classish white males. And as a country with a really strange population density, i.e. there's a lot of people sort of stuck around Oslo, and then people are dotted all over the countryside. And it was a very fertile ground for sort of subcultures and music to take over and sort of be developed. Because of the Norwegian government's model, what they would actually do is they would encourage young people to play instruments, and they would give tax breaks and sort of financial incentives in order to set up like music classes and that sort of thing. So the kids were pushed in towards making music. But socially, there was quite a strict, not so much ban, but strict censorship on any sort of media violence getting through. So, and obviously kids who want to see that sort of thing will go and find it anyway. So there was a lot of black market sort of horror movies and things that being spread around. And one of the kids, Øystein Aarseth, went on to be the guitarist in Mayhem. He loved these movies, and he was watching music videos, listening to music, and he came across a band from Newcastle called Venom. Now, Venom were like the first band to really sort of push the idea of black metal. Aesthetically, they were black metal. Sonically, not so much. Sonically, they were more sort of like proto-thrash sort of model.
Kind of Motorhead-y, but a bit scuzzier and that sort of thing, yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things that people miss out on Venom, if they haven't actually sort of seen them or heard them, aside from a couple of songs, is they were mainly tongue-in-cheek. It was primarily they were having a laugh. Now, Aarseth didn't really sort of get that. He missed out on this sort of idea that they were basically taking the pee and thought that they were dead serious. So he wanted to take this music forward. He'd got the government support in which to do it. And he realised that in order to make this extreme music, he would have to A, look extreme, and B, act in an extreme manner. So the scene that he created, that many other people joined, became all about the presentation of evil. Unfortunately, it was a very sort of schlocky horror kind of satanic evil that they developed, because it was what they'd seen in movies. And also, as my research puts forward, the most evil thing that they could think of at the time was Nazism. So a few of them created this performative political space in which they started to mockingly, not seriously, put themselves over as being Nazis or fascists. Now, the problem with that is that once you've created that space for performative politics, people who really do sort of believe in it start to enter and co-opt it. So that's when you get in guys like Varg Vikernes, who he didn't develop Nazism as a result of black metal. He was playing in skinhead bands during the 80s. He was quite sort of a fan of these of Nazi politics at that time. But even then, when we consider the idea of Nazi politics, what we're actually seeing in the black metal scene is this approximate link, well, proximal link between Nazism and the pagan religion that that people like Vikernes believed was overrun and forced out by the advance of Christianity. If you look through the like sort of Elder Futhark runes, what you see is a lot of the symbols that the runes represent were then co-opted by Nazis. Ideas like the swastika, solid, these sort of ideas, which appeared quite frequently among pagan runes too, for similar sort of purposes, like, you know, strength, guidance, wisdom, these sort of symbols were co-opted by Nazis and became known as Nazi symbols. So there's a lot of areas of crossover, but it's a lot more complicated than someone saying, "Oh, the black metal scene full of Nazis," because there's push and pull factors in this sort of way. How can I put this? Basically, the problem with the black metal scene was there was this space where all this pagan religion and all this sort of anti-Christian hatred found its own niche. And it's what was started out as being performative politics, then sort of got out of hand. Because there started to be this situation of a macabre upmanship that went on, which that led to elements of criminality, i.e. the suicide of the lead singer of Mayhem at the time, which was quickly followed by, amazingly quickly followed, when Arseth was first to find a dead's body and took photographs of the corpse, which then somehow appeared as an album cover for a sort of semi-legit bootleg of a live recording that they did. It was also rumoured to have taken parts of Dead's skull and turn it into necklaces, which he would give to other members of the black metal scene, which he deemed as worthy. I believe the lead singer of Marduk claims to have one.
But that's pretty interesting, because one thing that I was going to talk to you about in relation to all of this stuff was kind of a follow-on from, we did a previous interview at the Home of Metal, I think it was about a year ago now, where we briefly touched on this. And, you know, there's always, when discussing this sort of thing, there's always a lot of space to dive deeper into things. But because it was sort of supposed to be a celebration of the history of heavy metal, I didn't want to drill too deep into links to Nazism and all of that sort of stuff. But what you've just said then maps quite nicely onto something that I was going to talk to you about, this sort of idea of stochastic terrorism. I don't know if that's something that you've encountered yourself, but just for anybody who's not aware, it's kind of this idea, it kind of maps the pyramid of violence that I believe was originally used to model sexual violence in, you know, sort of the case of sexual violence onto ideological extremism, as it were, in that you start at sort of a base level of you have your underlying biases, and then it increases to sort of verbal microaggressions and then verbal expression of these ideas right through to manifesting as physical violence and potentially, you know, much more extreme than that. So that does sound like that's kind of what happens. You have these people sort of almost normalizing and desensitizing other people to this extreme idea just through the use of the aesthetics, whether it's deliberate or not. And then that allows people to sort of progress down this extreme path. Is that kind of the sort of thing that would have happened?
I would say that would be an 100% accurate sort of portrayal. I believe that a lot of the reasons for the constant sort of escalation of the violence was a lot to do with the attainment of what we call subcultural capital, which can be understood basically as cool points.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's if we want to sort of take a base example of that, if we look at the church arsons, it's right at the beginning of the church arsons, it was members of the black metal inner circle, the validity of whether they actually existed as an entity or they were just a loose group of friends is immaterial at the moment. But it was like a smaller group of people that were committing these fires. And as the sort of fires sort of spread through the news, others were sort of like, okay, maybe they started listening to black metal and they wanted to become known within the scene. So they would commit, they would start fires in churches in Norway and Sweden as well. In order to become notorious within the scene. So I believe a lot of it was to do with this idea of attaining subcultural capital and becoming more important within the scene.
So sort of almost modelling kind of like a social market dynamic in a way, more than sort of a traditional loosely associated group where there's not necessarily the drive to become as prominent in the same ways.
I would agree. Yeah, I'd say that's that's pretty accurate. I mean, it's for a while this sort of escalation was kept very much within the black metal main group, shall we say? But unfortunately, that didn't. And for Arseth, that was enough. But there were others like Vikernes who really wanted to be sort of infamous, as in, you know, like on a wider scale. And sort of they didn't sort of care for the idea of keeping it in within themselves. I mean, right at the start of the Norwegian black metal scene, it was meant to be this most elitist and exclusive of subcultures, where you've got to have, you know, like an iron constitution, and you've got to be dedicated to like the performance of evil and death, air quotes massively there, in order to sort of be part of his gang. I mean, we're talking about a guy who in Arseth that bought a record store and could control what his followers were listening to that way, and also owned a record label and could control what his listeners were that way, what listeners were checking out that way. So this was a man who wanted to control as much of those below him as possible. And this was outside of the escalation of violence. This was basically just about subcultural capital.
I mean, that's kind of an interesting thing to think about, in that, you know, as I've been writing the larger piece, I've positioned sort of the culture of heavy music in general as something that's supposed to be quite open and accepting of everybody, you know, sort of regardless of what genre, subgenres we touch on, particularly with that. But it sounds like black metal was almost a rejection of that more seemingly community oriented thing that, you know, I personally feel about heavy metal, and I know a lot of other people do. Is that kind of an accurate reflection of what was going on then?
That was perfectly accurate. Black metal, from Arseth's point of view, was meant to be a complete rejection of everything that had happened in metal up to that point. I mean, this was... This guy, he communicated with Shane Embury of Napalm Death quite openly, but to his to the public, or to, you know, the rest of his scene, it was basically, oh no, 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 you don't want to listen to Napalm Death and that stuff. That's life metal. That's too involved in social issues and politics. Ignore that. It's crap. Right. After Dead Suicide, Arseth put out statements in various sort of fanzines at the time that Dead killed himself because he couldn't stand this crappy death metal that was around. You know,
that's amazing. Like, in a very morbid way, that's kind of like there's dedication to sort of the, like, I guess, believing your own hype, as it were, but like to put that out about someone who's like a close associate of yourself having taken their own life, that's really, is kind of contextualizes for me how seriously they would have taken it all.
Yeah. Oh yeah, the subject matter itself was very quickly overtaken by their dedication to this sort of meta body. Right. I mean, as they formed this sort of mythology, and that's how they began to see it. If you read some of the literature on sort of the Mayhem archives, for instance, right? If you check that out, you can physically see, you can map them picking out little narratives and little stories that they can build together to form this sort of myth of being like, of being Mayhem being the most dangerous band in the world.
So, you know,
it's very much about controlling narrative.
That's just sort of, you know, as someone who's not hugely involved in it, it's you get an idea of what's going on, sort of almost that there is this, especially in sort of extreme metal and black metal, you get the idea that it's very insular, but I've never had the idea that that's how seriously they took it in the first place. I mean, nowadays you obviously have people who are less serious and almost parodied to an extent, but the way that a band like Behemoth recently with their live show are sort of referencing those old aspects of, you know, church burnings and all of that sort of thing, it has sort of become a myth of the genre of itself. You know, Behemoth for spraying fire into an abandoned church for a live stream because of current global events. It just really contextualizes how important that narrative is, even to this day, to people who are involved in that scene, I guess.
Absolutely. I mean, the more that bands sort of reframe this in sort of their own reverence, right, then the further it becomes mythologized. I mean, we've now got bands like Behemoth that are doing their sort of thing and sort of coming out as fascist, and we've also got bands like Gorgoroth and Wataine especially, who take a lot of the sort of ideas of the evil aesthetic and they really push that through in their live shows. Gorgoroth have sort of toned it down over the last sort of 10 years. But there is this element of bands like Wataine that they cover things in pig's blood. They make things, they want a show to be sort of like more than just going to see a band. They want it to be carnival. They want it to be, you know, performance art. And that is all coming from the black metal bands that back then, when Mayhem and stuff were still playing sort of really small venues, because a lot of the larger venues weren't really interested. And it also goes to explain some way that recordings of black metal in the early days were so crappy and lo-fi, not because studios chose to give them that, but studios weren't interested in recording them. So they did everything pretty much DIY. But that was added onto the mythology. But, you know, our recordings stink of death. Right, so
it's almost very... like propaganda in a way, in that they take everything and spin it to add to their own sort of, to how they want to be perceived by people,
yes,
to increase the attention on them.
Yes. I mean, the early black metal bands, when they were playing in the small venues, like I tried to sort of get into, they weren't doing all this like sick stuff with, you know, goat's blood and naked virgins on crosses and that sort of thing. They weren't doing that. That was taken up later in a sort of bizarre ritualistic tribute. You know, because of this, the idea that we've allowed the subculture of black metal in Norway to become this sort of folkloric element, then it's going to keep coming back and sort of escalating, hopefully in a non-violent way.
Yeah. So I guess this is all sort of kind of adjacent to the general thesis of the article that I'm writing, in that the kind of the main point that I'm trying to argue throughout is that even removing lyrical content, removing even almost the music itself, heavy music is inevitably and inextricably political because of sort of the societies that it's created in, and how those societies react to that music in and of itself. You know, I've gone right back to very early rock and roll to discuss about how that is political, and obviously rock and roll carries forwards into you know, heavy metal as it was created in the late 60s, early 70s. Is that something, you know, how did the sort of political climate at the time reflect on what was made in black metal? Because, you know, obviously we've touched on the government support and that sort of thing, but
okay, well,
sort of rounded sense.
A more rounded sense. Now, the Norwegian is an interesting fact for you. The Norwegian constitution recommends that 50% of the Storting, which is the Norwegian parliament, consists of practicing Christians.
That's interesting. I can kind of see where this is going now, but yeah, that's
right.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, this is a country where, in some of the later sort of Eurobarometer tests, at least 6% of the population would openly say they are Christian and that they believe in God, right? Also, the way that, particularly in the 90s, that Norwegian society worked, you were born into the church. You didn't have a choice as to whether you entered the church. You were born into it. You had to opt out.
Oh.
Right? There was no, it wasn't like in England or in the UK or here, where we have Christian christening ceremonies to enter somebody into the church symbolically. That was, you were expected to be a part of the church from birth. So in that respect, in Norway, a reaction, a political protest or a protest against, say, the churches, i.e. a church burning, is also very much a political protest, because there is a massive over-influence of Christianity at Norway at a political level. 50% of the people, 50% of the parliament represents practically 6% of the population.
Yeah, so it's quite easy to see then how, you know, that then shapes sort of this, you know, as well as co-opting far-right aesthetics, they co-opted satanic aesthetics, and obviously the church burnings are a very visceral example of that kind of thinking carried through. Is it fair to say then that there was quite a well, obviously when you get to the point of church burnings and all that sort of thing, of course you're going to have quite a visceral reaction from sort of the mainstream society in Norway at the time, but sort of even before it got to that point, was there much of a pushback and reaction to it, or was it so underground that it was hard for there to be a mainstream response to it?
Well, Norway, culturally, they are very, very permissive. As long as you qualify under the sort of Lighet principle, which I'll get to in a second. But I mean, about take for this example, I want to take you away from black metal for a second, right? Do you remember when Venables and Thompson killed Jamie Bulger?
No, not off the top of my head, no.
Well, no, but you will have heard about it, right? We, in this country, we reacted very, very, very badly. We actually ended up reducing the age of criminal responsibility from 14 to 10 because of this case.
Now, all right. Now I know what you're talking about, yeah.
Within a few months of that happening, a similar case happened in Norway, right? A young girl, Silge Redegard, was attacked and killed. Well, she was attacked and stripped naked and left to die in the snow by two boys. Now, Norway's reaction to that was they did not criminalize the boys. Nobody knows their identities. And they were basically allowed to rejoin and return to life, right? You can go to the village where it happened now, and people are aware of who these two boys are, but the media was never made aware. Right? They were allowed to go back to their life. It's a very sort of permissive, progressive environment. If you have Lighet. Okay. Now, Lighet is a Swedish term, that basically translates as likeness. And what we mean by that is visual likeness. So, I mean, we're two white guys, yeah?
Yeah.
We could go to Norway, not speak an iota of the language, and get along absolutely fine. You can be black or Arabic, not so much today, but about sort of 10 years ago, 20 years ago, if you were black and Arabic, you could speak perfect Norwegian and still feel like you were being isolated and sort of segregated. There is an element of a far right problem in Norway. Right, I don't, you know, I'm not trying to offend anybody, but there is. And that is how we end up with people like Anders Breivik. Because those people were, you know, they were completely against this sort of wave of Islamification of Norway. By that, they were against all immigration. But society, Norwegian society in general, is very, very accepting because of their social democratic model. But there is this dying or underlying far right problem.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that sort of Lighet principle is kind of similar to, you know, the kind of creation of in-groups and out-groups that far-right ideology thrives off of.
Exactly.
That, I guess, makes it more understandable how much, firstly, how much it seems that, I guess, you know, Varg is now out of jail because I guess he was part of the in-group, so they were more accepting of that kind of from what you've explained there, it would be my inference from that. And then, you know, also how that would kind of map on to the more genuinely extreme parts of the black metal scene then would have that sort of in-group and out-group thing sort of built into their culture already. And it's only a few more steps to taking it to a further extreme that then goes on to cause violence and problems, I guess.
Precisely, yes.
Brilliant. So there wasn't, so I guess what you're saying with the kind of Lighet thing is there wasn't as much of a reaction to it as we might have expect over here, because, you know, when heavy metal came around, we had that one inverted cross on the inside of a Black Sabbath album. And there was kind of the moral panic over Satanism here when that happened. there wouldn't have been really the same thing going on when black metal at least started out.
Well, the if you look at how sort of our attitude as a country to the church is, we sort of, you know, like, it's the idea of the separation of church and state. I know that's not us, that's America, but it's very much the same idea, right?
Yeah.
So an attack on the church or an attack on sort of Christianity in this country doesn't even raise an eyebrow.
Mm. Yeah.
If you look forward to some of like the more black metal sort of UK sort of stunts, any sort of transgression against religion has been a lot more ideological. You don't burn churches down in the UK. And there's a very good reason for that, because our churches are made of stone. Their churches are made of wood.
Yeah.
Wood burns a lot easier. But the most sort of prolific example of a black metal anti-Christian act in the UK was an old Cradle of Filth T-shirt that said Jesus is a C word.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It's banned, isn't it? Yeah, it is banned. People were arrested for wearing that T-shirt, right? Mm. And Danny Filth, in an interview, basically said, well, if you're going to be stupid enough to wear that, you deserve to be arrested, right? So, and that's not exact. That's hardly sort of transgressing of religious boundaries, because there aren't really any. What it was, is it was transgressing boundaries of public decency.
Mm. Sort of the idea of seeking to, I guess, upset people. It doesn't really matter necessarily that they had this religious connotation. It was more, this is just something that's going to push people's buttons in a way, rather than
you can't say this in public.
Yeah,
you know, like how dare you have a T-shirt with a masturbating nun on it? You know,
that makes a lot of sense. So is there anything about sort of it's very difficult to, obviously it's very difficult to make general statements about such a diverse scene as black metal and heavy music as a whole, but how much does sort of the political roots that played into sort of that second wave that carry through to what's going on in the scene now, and the weight that it carries in terms of the wider culture, I guess?
There are still a lot of people. I remember sort of around sort of 2006 when Vikernes was originally going to be released. And a lot of people were waiting for him to sort of say something. A lot of people still held respect for a guy who hadn't produced a decent piece of music in a very long time. That element of reverence of godhood within the scene was very important.
Mm.
There are still sort of pockets of black metal that really hold true reverence for this, for the second wave. Mm. Even guys that you would really not think about it, like Wolves in the Throne Room. Right.
Yeah.
The Weaver Brothers have been pictured in Burzum T-shirts, and they owe a lot of their sort of sound to original Burzum recordings.
Mm.
So, I think what we've sort of got. I mean, it's not exactly fetishistic disavowal, which is essentially a term that we use as criminologists to describe a. Where we can sort of pick and choose what we like about something, and we can pretend that the bad stuff hasn't happened.
Mm.
It's cognitive dissonance.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so there's a lot of that going on. I mean, it's to outsiders, black metal has not really moved out the shadow of what happened in Norway. A lot of people are put off black metal simply because of that. You know, you get the idea that, or that the media scare that, oh, don't listen to that song, you'll end up burning a church or something.
Mm.
Right. But within it, with what they're basically sort of saying, okay, this is important to us as a people as a subculture, as a scene, but we treat it with more profanely. They treat it with more of a sort of flexibility now. That is why there's a lot of more sort of left-leaning black metal bands now. Mm. I mean, there's a whole scene called RABM, Red and Black Metal.
Yeah, the sort of anarchist sort of side of things, I guess.
Yeah. A best example of that, a band called Dawn Raid.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of buzz about them going around recently, yeah.
They're really good. Really, really worth listening to.
Mm.
Yeah. Yes.
It's kind of similar then, I guess, in a way to something that I've said about punk as I've been writing, in that, you know, it was a scene that sort of had this very sort of anarchistic aesthetic to it, but was obviously also had a far right problem, to put it mildly, to an extent. But due to that sort of conflict with it and sort of this desire within the scene to move away from some of the worst aspects of it, kind of leads to this sort of depoliticization of the scene. Because, you know, these days punk bands are less political in their lyrical narratives, so we can still see sort of the politics of the politics that sort of birthed the scene affecting what it's gone on to become as time goes on. Do you think that also maps onto where black metal is now?
It does in a way. I mean, I belong to a school of thought that says that there is no non-political act.
Yeah.
Every act to a degree is political.
Mm-hmm.
And the lack of political engagement in music is as important politically as somebody who engages it with it directly.
Mm-hmm.
So while a lot of the sort of black metal bands never really sort of engage with politics in their music, for they were sort of talked really much about, you know, evil and suicide and death and that sort of thing, right? The political wing was very much that undercurrent. That's still there, but it's a lot more pliable, it's a lot more flexible. What we're seeing now is a lot more black metal bands using politics as a sonic template than we did before.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really sort of concur with the depoliticization of black metal.
Okay.
I think it's more of a repoliticization. It's a reframing. It's taken the political element from here and put it right out front.
Okay, that's definitely not necessarily how I would have perceived it from sort of an outside perspective, but that's definitely an interesting dynamic, I guess, is that they have this sort of looming, quite appropriately, I guess, a looming spectre over the whole scene, and they're sort of almost reclaiming it and recontextualizing it in the modern sense, with almost a rejection of some of the old politics. Though obviously there'll still be some bands who exist who indulge in the same sort of avenues. That's a really interesting thing about the scene in general, I guess. Is there anything else sort of about the politics of black metal that you think is worth discussing sort of in a wider context of things, just to make sure that I cover all of my bases on it, really?
Well, what I find very interesting is the ease in which a lot of the second wave the second wave sound bled into the Cascadian scene. That there's, because black metal has always had this element of ecology to it. There's always been, you know, a lot of talk about, you know, like forests, a lot of talk about decay, particularly the Norwegian wind, because, you know, they are surrounded by it. British black metal has a very sort of different sort of themic build-up, simply because it's a reaction to your socio-political surroundings.
Mm.
In Norway, because they're surrounded by forests, their music was about forests quite a lot of the time. They sort of saw the nature as a sort of oppressive force that was taking over humanity. But that reverence for nature was there. And that bled very, very easily into bands like Skagos, Wolves in the Throne Room, Weakling, who sort of managed to strip out the abject hatred, but keep this reverence for nature. And there was also the idea of the commonality, that of the clash between humans and nature. So there was this very, very easy bleed across. And that, to me, that is where the idea of the repoliticization of black metal came from. Because they were like, they took that sort of flora and fauna sort of aspect and moved it forward in the sound. Nobody was going to say, oh, Burzum talks a lot about trees.
Yeah.
People quite content to say, oh, Wolves in the Throne Room talk a lot about trees.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's sort of become a more environmentally conscious sort of eco movement, as it were. In the Mormon time, that's fascinating. Actually, that's really interesting. Not an angle that you see discussed much, I suppose. I think that just about covers everything that I want to talk to you about. I know when I first spoke to you about doing this interview, you mentioned that you're writing a chapter on a book covering a similar sort of topic. Do you want to talk about that quickly so people are aware of what that is and when that's coming up?
Okay, well, the book is essentially, the entirety of the book is about politics and music and their sort of combination and how they sort of interlink. Mm-hmm. My chapter is the working title is Black Metal, A Space for Performative Politics. Mm-hmm. And I basically just sort of talk about what I have just spoken to you about, the idea that black metal created this evil space which began to be populated by people who were into Nazi politics. Mm-hmm. But it's always been led by an aesthetic and a sonic soundscape that can be made flexible and made pliable. There's a number of implications within that, mm-hmm. That certain people in certain scenes have taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Norwegian scene, very, very deep in terms of forestry and the countryside, because that's what they knew. The English black metal scene, you'll find there's a lot more references to industry, to the fall of industry and that sort of thing, because that's what we're used to. Mm. Our living situation is a lot more urban than it is in Norway. If you listen to Scottish black metal, that is like a clash between the two sides, because whereas the Norwegians talked a lot about wolves, as you will have known by listening to any single black metal song, the English don't. The Scottish, they do have wild wolves. So we're back to talking about wolves again.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'll have to keep an eye out for when the book does come out. But yeah, is there any sort of time frame when it might be released so people can keep an eye out for it? Or is it still work in progress kind of thing?
Well, I'm just finishing the chapter off now. I believe it should be submitted in January, but thanks to COVID, academia has taken a massive hit when it comes to putting stuff out. I should have had a book out, a chapter and a book out last year, but that's still not out, you know, so don't think about that. I mean, I just released a book over summer that me and my friends wrote, and that's been sitting on the shelf for a while until it came out. So,
yeah, well, it's a very strange time to be putting anything out at the moment. But thanks very much for speaking to us, and we'll keep an eye out for when the book does come out and see if we can find a way to fit it in among talking about it in among our regular content. Just as a thank you for speaking to us and all of that sort of thing.
No worries. So thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no worries whatsoever. Thank you.
MMH. the home of rock radio.